This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, July 5th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's Ozarks, a pair of recent conversations we heard here that we thought appropriate to hear again. In just a moment, Antoinette Grajeda will talk to an immigration attorney about asylum, immigration, and more. Then, in about 15 minutes, Zuzana Sitek helps us understand the possible impact tariffs could have on Arkansas. By the way, if you can't always be with us at noon or 7 for an edition of Ozarks at Large, you can listen to us on your schedule. We have an Ozarks at Large podcast that is free, no tariffs, through services like iTunes and Stitcher. You can also find past individual stories and interviews and past complete editions of Ozarks at Large at ozarksatlarge.com. The most recent editions of Ozarks at Large also available, again for free, on the free KUAF app. This weekend on the TED Radio Hour, Sunday afternoon at 1 on 91.3, how many friends do you really have? Even if you count everyone you know or like on Facebook or Instagram, it's probably going to add up to one number, 150. How our networks work on the next TED Radio Hour, Sunday afternoon at 1 on 91.3 KUAF. All right, in case you haven't noticed yet, Bentonville drivers, Tiger Boulevard between Bella Vista Road and Northwest A Street in downtown Bentonville, scheduled to be closed today, but be patient. It should be open again by 6 tonight. It is about 6.5 minutes after 12. This is Ozarks at Large. What happens to migrant children once they reach the United States border has been a much-discussed topic over the past few months. First, there was the announcement that the Trump administration has instituted a policy of separating children from their parents at the border. Then, last month, the president signed an executive order ending that policy of family separation. Officials are still working on the process of reuniting some of those migrant families. To sort through some of the immigration law surrounding migrant children, we reached out to Laura Ferner, a partner at Crouch, Harwell, Fryer, and Ferner. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda visited the Springdale-based law firm last month, where Laura Ferner explained what happens to unaccompanied minors who show up to the U.S. border depends on what country they're from.
In 2008, there was a law that passed. It's called the Unaccompanied Minors in the Trafficking Victim Protection Act of 2008. It's a TVPRA. And that passed in 2008, stating that children that come from basically anywhere south of the border except for Mexico, that these children are deemed to be asylum applicants and that they have the right to apply for asylum, and that custody of these children be transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and HSA. HSI, which I guess is like our version of the federal version of like Child and Welfare Services. And these children are then to be placed with family members or close family members or close family friends, or like in the best possible scenario. And then usually that happens. So a few years ago, I guess in 2013, I started representing the first kids in 2008, 2009. And then there was a big influx, I want to say maybe in 2012 or 13, when there was like, I think one year we had like over 40,000 children come. And I saw a big influx of unaccompanied minors coming to me. And a lot of times these children then were referred to social services, like private social services, like Lutheran social services. And I had a social worker contact me a lot. And other nonprofits contacted me a lot. So I did a lot of those cases for pro bono for a while.
So once the kids got sent to you, then what happens? Because they're still part of a legal process. The first part of putting them with their family is just the first part of that process.
Yes. So the majority of these kids were teens. So a lot of times they were first placed into group homes all over the country. And at that point, then it was ascertained where the closest family member was. A lot of times these children did have at least one parent in the United States, sometimes two. And so if parents could be found, they were placed in custody with the parents. And that's how these kids ended up in Arkansas, a lot of them. And from there, they still had immigration court proceedings. So at that point, then it was decided what, you know, if they've had lawyers like me or other nonprofits, I guess, then, you know, you decided what was the best legal strategy at that point to do.
And so with some of the kids that you've had, I guess they're applying for asylum, and then that's a whole judicial process that you kind of take them through.
Yes. So if a child is designated as an unaccompanied minor, they get to apply for asylum with Immigration Services, the asylum office, instead of the court. And the benefit to that is that it feels less threatening and less intimidating, because you file the application with an office and then you go to an interview with an officer, and it's just the officer and you and I guess your lawyer. And they just kind of, it's like a conversation like you and I are having, and they're just asking questions about why you left your country, what are you afraid of, and making those determinations.
Have a lot of your clients been able to get asylum?
It's hard for me to get a number. So when somebody comes to me, I do a screening process to see if you qualify for asylum, because if you do not and you file what is in the law we call a frivolous application for asylum, you can actually get in legal trouble. This means that if you file an application with false information, not a weak claim, just because you lose your asylum claim to case doesn't mean it's a frivolous application. It just means it didn't meet the criteria of asylum. But it's somebody who would make up stuff or lie about stuff. And at that point, then you decide how strong the case is, and you try to see if there's other avenues to stay here in this country or not.
Yeah. So there's other avenues other than asylum for some of these people?
For some children, there is a process called the Special Juvenile Immigrant Visa, and that is for children who have been abused or neglected or abandoned by at least one parent. And that reunification, and that has a predicate to it that there is a state court or a juvenile court that has decided that it is not in the best interest of that child to return to their home country, or that they that reunification with their parents or both one or both parents is not a viable option.
Okay, so that's an option. Say I apply for asylum and I get asylum, what's the next step?
Okay, so if you apply for asylum and you're granted asylum, then you're considered an asylee. And after 1 year of being an asylee, you can apply for residency, legal permanent residency, or adjustment of status is the correct term.
And then from there, like other permanent residents, you can go on to possibly apply for citizenship after a certain amount of time and qualifications and that whole long process.
That's correct. So after 5 years, and if you're over the age of 18, you can apply for citizenship.
Okay, so there are options. In the immigration world, how often does it happen that someone gets asylum? Is that something that happens often, or?
Well, it's pretty hard, and it's especially hard for a lot of these kids who, you know, they don't have the monetary funds to hire attorneys, and now legal funding for a lot of these organizations that provided legal representation for these children has been cut. So a lot of these organizations have no money at all to represent children, which is extremely hard. So I'm going to try to explain to you the qualifications for asylum. So then you see how hard it is to actually get asylum, and then especially if you're pro se, meaning you don't have legal representation. So the law of asylum is ever evolving, and it dates back to, like, you know, human rights conventions and things like that. But in the United States, if you apply for asylum, you have to show that you have suffered past persecution, or you have a well-founded fear of future persecution on account of one of the five enumerated grounds. And these are your race, your political opinion, your religion, your ethnicity, or your membership in a particular social group, okay? Well, now, most of these children that come from Central America, they would fall under the particular social group realm, because, you know, most of these children are Catholic or Christian, and those kids are not being persecuted. You're not being persecuted usually for that in El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras. So it comes down to the definition of a particular social group, and I have to look it up every single time, I argue, because it changes all the time, and it's also very complicated. So this particular social group has to be particularly defined, meaning there has to be limits to the bounds. It has to be socially distinct, meaning that it is recognized as a group in the society. Doesn't have to, it used to be that it had to be socially visible, that people, you had to be recognized as that such, and and that it is comprised of members that have a trade that should not, that they cannot or they should not be required to change. So like gender, for example, has been held to be a social group. Now, as I said, this definition changes constantly, and it's hard for us lawyers to keep track of it. I can't imagine what it would be like for a pro se client to go before the immigration court or the asylum office and articulate this, his or hers membership in a particular social group. And the last part of that is that the government cannot or doesn't want to stop the actor from persecuting you. So you have to meet all of those in order to qualify for asylum. So it's an extremely hard thing to do.
And I imagine a lot of people who come here seeking asylum don't know all that. They just know that they hear the word asylum or think that there's a safe place, and so they give it a go.
Correct. I mean, there's just no way, a lot of people don't know. You know, they just, I mean, a lot of these people come here because they have a real fear, right? And especially kids. They are afraid. A lot of them don't have parents that live in the that live in their countries. A lot of these parents live in the United States and have for a long time, and so they are not protected by anybody. They're the most vulnerable population in those countries, and a lot of times they had aging grandparents that have passed away or other reasons. You know, there's many reasons why some of these kids come: gang violence, gang recruitment efforts, domestic violence victims. I mean, anything that you can think of has happened to some of these kids. And then a lot of them, unfortunately and sadly, get extorted and exploited on the way down, or up, I guess.
Right, coming north from South America, yeah. In Central America. One of the reasons these unaccompanied minors have been in the news lately is because an official with the Department of Health and Human Services reported that the government has lost track of, or some wording like that, lost track of about 1,500 kids that they're missing. And there's been a lot of reports on that, and then some reports after that to kind of explain what they mean by missing. Because I think when you hear a child is missing, you think, you know, they were snatched and taken somewhere, or maybe ran away, even when we say missing. But as far as the, I guess, legal definition, it's not quite that in this situation.
Correct. I think the term missing is a little misleading. I mean, it's, so like I said, these children are then often released. Once they come here, they are released to their parents or other family members or other close family friends, or something of that nature. And within the recent year, last year, the government started to, upon check-ins with the Office of Refugee Resettlement and other places, or when they went to court, some of the parents started getting arrested, were being arrested. So at this point, then, these children are a little scared to show up to court. In addition to, these are children, these are teenagers, and I don't know, I'm sure most people can sympathize with this, but, you know, sometimes my daughter, who is a teen, doesn't answer her phone. Okay, I mean, sometimes I can't get a hold of her for a full day, you know, when I'm at work and she's off school or whatever. So I think that's also something. Just because somebody doesn't answer their phone doesn't mean they're lost. Or when people have changed their phone numbers, a lot of my clients change their phone numbers and don't advise me of it, even though I tell them, I need you to tell me, and they don't advise me. And then sometimes I don't hear from them for like a year until like, they're like, oh yeah, I need to go check on my case. And then I've been trying to get a hold of them and I can't. So there are many variables as to why these children are not in contact
So it's as simple as they were calling to check in on these people. Maybe they didn't answer the phone, or maybe they didn't return the phone call, or maybe the number has changed. And so it's just they're not entirely sure where they are. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're lost in the traditional sense.
That's correct. They're not lost in the traditional sense. And also there's been reports about some of these children being released to human traffickers. And I find that report to be highly misleading because a lot of parents recently have been labeled human traffickers because they brought their children here or funded the coyotes who brought the children here. And to me, that is then to say that these children are being released to human traffickers, and there's all this rampant abuse of children going on, is completely misleading. While I'm not going to say that there's no abuse, because there always is, but there's also in our foster care system in the state, there's some abuse, but that doesn't mean that all foster parents are abusive either. You know, it's kind of the same thing.
So by labeling a parent human trafficking, is this a legal definition, or is this just sort of one person's opinion that they're saying, oh, well, I'm calling them a human trafficker because they're taking this child from across the border?
There's actually been reports of parents being arrested at these check-ins and then being charged with the crime of human trafficking. And so that then prevents this parent in the future of becoming a permanent resident because they have that charge against them.
But not in all cases, but there have been some.
Yes, I personally haven't had any, mm-hmm. so I can't say that. But I do know of other attorneys that have had clients where this has happened.
That was immigration lawyer Laura Ferner speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Laura is a partner at Crouch, Harwell, Fryer, and Ferner, a law firm in Springdale. This is Ozarks at Large. In just a moment, an explanation of what tariffs might mean for Arkansas.
Support for KUAF comes from contributing listeners and from KUAF's sustaining members. KUAF's sustaining members take one simple action that helps make it possible for thousands to connect with news and ideas on KUAF for years to come. They set up a monthly donation that will continue for as long as they like. This monthly support provides reliable income to help pay for the programs we all rely on and enjoy. Thank you to the more than 1,000 sustaining members of KUAF. We appreciate your support.
Ozarks at Large has been following the Trump administration's decisions on tariffs since earlier this year. About a month ago, the president announced he was placing steel and aluminum tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and the European Union. Canada and Mexico are Arkansas's largest trade partners. Data from the Arkansas World Trade Center shows exports of goods to both countries increased by nearly 14% from 2016 to 2017. And last year, combined exports to Canada and Mexico added up to $2.1 billion. Just this weekend, Canada announced it imposed tariffs on U.S. exports worth more than $12 billion. More than 40 U.S. steel products now have 25% tariffs. Canada also put a 10% tax on over 80 other items, including maple syrup, coffee beans, and strawberry jam. In early June, Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek spoke with Angela Hoffman, Deputy Director of Farmers for Free Trade, about how these tariffs could have an impact on Arkansas's farmers and manufacturers.
Tariffs have been implemented on Canada and Mexico on their steel and aluminum. Can we just talk about what brought us to this point? That happened last week. But what's led us up to this point? It's been sort of a long process. It's been confusing.
Yes, well, you're right about it being confusing. So let me just try to simplify it in what's happening. So there's three big things that we're watching right now. One is the modernization or the renegotiation of NAFTA, and that involves Canada and Mexico. This is something that needs to be done. You know, it's an agreement that was started in 1992, so it needs modernized. It doesn't need to be throwing out the baby with bathwater. So that's been one thing that's very important, but that deal is not done. So that's hanging in the balance. Number two, the president used a little-known trade agreement, a trade authority called 232, which is used for national security. And that was invoked across many, many, many countries involving steel and aluminum. And that allows the president unilaterally to impose tariffs. So these are big tariffs. Now, our Canadian and Mexican counterparts were exempted temporarily. So that's the big caveat here, temporarily exempted. And then number three, we're in the midst of a 301. So this is a special investigation on China. So there's a lot of talk about imposing, again, taxes or tariffs on Chinese imports. So we have three big things going on right now. The last couple of weeks were kind of the perfect storm. So number one, the NAFTA talks did not conclude. And the president said very forcefully when he made the exemption that if the talks didn't conclude by June 1st, he was going to put Canada and Mexico back on the steel and aluminum list. That's where we are now. So you now have additional taxes for the state of Arkansas on imports of steel and aluminum from Canada and Mexico. And our manufacturers use a lot of those products. It's really important to their profitability that they're able to use an integrated supply chain. And number two, guess what? When you take a provision that is sort of out of context, it's not trade legal, your trading partners get to retaliate. And that's what's happening right now. So we've got tariffs on the other side. So those great products that Arkansas depend on exporting to their number one and number two trading partners, well, they're now going to face some big stiff tariffs on the outbound side. So we're kind of caught in the crosshairs between these three big major issues related to trade. But at the end of the day, it has a real life economic impact on Arkansas. And our governor has been standing up for NAFTA throughout the entire year. It's been such an important topic for this state because it supports over 350,000 good Arkansas jobs. Those exports are agriculture, it's light manufacturing, it's airplane parts. We really rely on Canada and Mexico, our number one and number two. That's over $3 billion worth of exports that come from our state.
So Canada made a list, announced a list of the items that they will retaliate with. That isn't going into effect until later this month. But you mentioned Mexico is our other biggest trade partner, and they are also retaliating as we speak.
Yes. Well, and today they announced and put into effect their retaliation list. Now, this is phase one. So hopefully this does not go long because this is a self-inflicted war. But we've got key issues, and agriculture is right in the middle of that list. Apples, pork. A number of products that we saw retaliated on a couple years ago during this sort of Mexican trucking dispute. So these can be pretty painful, and they can really stop a lot of our trade and the most profitable market that we have for Arkansas products.
NAFTA, it seems like, has benefited Arkansas in a lot of ways. So where do, I guess, you know, manufacturers, farmers stand in all this? What are the worries for them?
Arkansas has really benefited from NAFTA. In fact, since the implementation in 1992, our trade has expanded 700%. That's huge. And again, it's not just agriculture. It's also manufacturing. Lots of good jobs. Over 1,000 small, medium-sized companies in the state rely on NAFTA. They're exporting everything. It's pretty exciting to see it. Now, it is linked, though, to the steel tariffs because the president said it was. He was exempting them for a short term, so they could conclude the deal on NAFTA. So a couple important things. One, we need to stay in NAFTA. This delegation in our state has been very vocal about continuing the benefits. We need to get it modernized. That's absolutely right. But what we don't want to see is yet another situation where, goodness gracious, we pull out of NAFTA. That you can't bear any more brunt of this economic war. Our farmers and producers just can't do it. They're seeing increase to their costs. They're seeing lost market. In the farm country, you're seeing sort of the dual side of this trade war. So not only are your markets being questioned, I mean, we export a lot of corn, grains, and more. Our buyers in Mexico are looking to other markets. They're already implementing deals from Argentina and around the world. Other people can sell the products, not our great products, but they can sell it. And number two, their costs are going up. Sort of the unintended consequences of these steel and aluminum import tariffs are the fact that their implements are more expensive. The fencing that they need to put in is more expensive, and that's going up exponentially. So they're crunched right in the middle, and it's financially very difficult.
How are these manufacturers and farmers handling this, I suppose? Can they prepare for anything? I mean, there's been so much talk of this and so much confusion, and we just don't know what's going to happen in a couple of weeks, let's say.
So one of the areas that we're seeing is it isn't just a short-term fix. So there's been a question about could, you know, a payment program or a supplemental program help? The real answer to that, and most of the producers we talk to say no, because these are long-term contracts. Take, for example, a barley grower on the Northern High Line selling their barley into Mexico. It becomes beer, and it's re-imported back to the U.S. they're getting into 10-year contracts. So it's not something that is easy to sort of turn around and find a new business partner. Similarly, there's markets where they've been working very, very hard. Keep in mind, China is also on the cutting edge. There are other tariffs and retaliatory tariffs in place that are happening. So you're seeing these other good markets that are also shutting down to U.S. products and blocking them out. So at the end of the day, where are you going to sell your product? And it's about the U.S. and the producers being reliable suppliers. And right now, that's what they need, is that reliability. They need some calm in this storm where they can see and make some plans for the short term, the midterm, and ultimately the long term, recognizing these deals take a lot of work and those relationships really, really matter.
So as far as your organization and other organizations in Arkansas, like the World Trade Center, that sort of work in trade and to promote Arkansas trade, what are you guys doing to sort of mitigate some of this?
Well, first, we're trying to explain what's going on. There's so much noise out there. It is confusing. It sounds like a lot of alphabet soup and a lot of numbers. And I think at the end of the day, we're trying to bring the message home that trade is basically just common sense economics. It's what do you do to sell your product? How do you simplify the way you sell it? And at the end of the day, how do you control your costs? And those stories, I think, really resonate when farmers and ranchers are speaking up. We've launched an app on www.farmersforfreetrade.com where you can record a 15-second video. And what really resonates are the individual stories. You know, what it looks like when a producer is making decisions about what they're going to plant because they're in the field right now, or what product they may or may not buy, whether they're going to put in a grain silo, whether they're going to fix that fence. Those are the type of stories that really, really resonate with this administration and need to be told. And frankly, you know, these are farmers who put Trump in office. They didn't vote for a trade war, but he's listening to them. So they really, really, really need to be able to articulate exactly how it's hitting their bottom line, their communities, and their family.
So it sounds like the worry is that that there might not be any benefits out of this trade war for farmers here and manufacturers here.
I think at the end of the day, most of the farmers and ranchers that we would talk about would say, let's get back in the business of selling things. You know, it's really important to keep in mind that we pulled out of the TPP. That would have opened an even larger market for new products to countries like Japan, where we've been working for years and years to be able to compete. We don't want to be sitting idly by while Canada and Mexico are negotiating agreements with all of our trading partners, the Australians as well. So we'd love to see those resources and the U.S. hand strengthened and doing what we do best is negotiating new and more open markets and resolving some of these disputes instead of the back foot.
This administration does sort of frame the argument that the U.S. is losing out in the global trade market. Is that the impression that you get?
So from an agriculture perspective, agriculture has a trade surplus and has. It continues to have a trade surplus even as last week when the numbers were released, almost a $20 billion trade surplus. So it's a different perspective. And I think you have to be careful to look at the numbers, look at the services industry. This is a highly complex, you know, trade that we have in the U.S. It's manufacturing, it's agriculture and services, but net-net, it's been positive. And to Arkansas, frankly, the numbers show that it's been a net positive for us and will continue to grow. This is a state that's highly, highly reliant on trade. It's done well. It's winning in trade. It has the right products and it has the right partners.
So let's talk about China really quickly, because that is part of the conversation. If we could just talk about what is happening with China, because right now the focus is on Canada, Mexico, and the EU. But all that stuff with China happened a little bit earlier. So I think it'd be good to maybe recap some of that.
Well, you know, it's really important to keep in mind that perhaps the trade deficit with China is what started all of this, is how do you reconcile that situation? And there are certain products where they have strengths, and there's certain areas where we have strengths. At the end of the day, on steel, they are already implementing retaliation against the U.S. That is happening. And we are seeing export tariffs on everything from nuts to wine already in effect. We are seeing orders canceled with product going into China, held up at port or other, you know, non-tariff barriers that are being implemented. So we've been picking that fight for a while. And the next phase is what's going to happen with respect to this 301, and that's intellectual property. And you know what? The U.S., and we support the efforts to make sure that our intellectual property rights are protected. That's a good and noble thing to do. We should be doing it. I think what everyone questions is whether or not just implementing more import tariffs or taxes is the right way to do it, because ultimately it's just the American consumer who pays that tax. So is there a better way to resolve our differences and not put yet another layer of complexity and confusion into the mix?
So are these trade negotiations, is this how they normally proceed, or is there something different this time?
It's a really interesting time because it's a combination of trade negotiations and trade tools out of a toolbox that are used on sort of other type of activities. So in the context of NAFTA and any trade negotiation, CAFTA, NAFTA, the TPP, industry members are very actively involved. So you would see representatives from your state who are very active and advising throughout the entire process. And they're heard, and their opinions really, really matter. You know, the last couple of rounds of NAFTA have been more at the top, and so there hasn't been as much visibility within the industry to what's happening. But the other trade tools, these numbers, we've moved from the sort of trade agreements to trade tools, the 232 and the 301. The 232 in particular is used for national security. It was used after the Korean War to protect the domestic steel industry. There was a very specific reason for using that tool, right? Now that tool is being used to leverage NAFTA talks. And so the question is, why are we using a national security tool to impose sanctions on our national security partners? And that's why Canada and Mexico and European Union are so very concerned, because they are our national security allies. So tools are being used in a very different manner. The other thing about these tools is they're unilateral. The president can invoke them without Congress. At the end of the day, if we look back to NAFTA, and this is important to note too, we can conclude a deal with NAFTA, but our Congress still has responsibility to pass the deal. And so they're not going to pass a bad deal either. So whatever you come back with, the president still has to work with his constituencies to make sure it's the right deal and it's good for America.
And are you hearing from farmers and manufacturers that they do feel like they're getting left out of the conversation about all this?
Certainly with respect to the retaliation. They do not appreciate being sort of the pawn in the trade war, because they are at the tip of the spear. And when you use a tool like this and you use it outside of its normal scope, our trading partners, and we've done it in the past too, we're authorized to retaliate. So they're doing what they can do under our global trade rules. And so I think that's been the hard part about this whole discussion is, you know, agriculture is overly bearing the brunt for how these tools are being used and how they are being focused on our trading partners.
If there was a message to sort of the people who are negotiating all this, imposing these tariffs, I mean, what would that be for coming from an Arkansas perspective?
So from an Arkansas perspective, these relationships matter. Mexico and Canada matter. They matter whether you're in agriculture, you're in manufacturing, you're in services. There are, again, over 350,000 good Arkansas jobs that matter. And we want to continue those relationships with our trading partners.
Right, because it sounds like NAFTA made Arkansas just quite a bit more prosperous as a state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a success story for NAFTA. I think the big question is, what can we do about it? You know, one thing right now to stabilize, would we resolve NAFTA, come to a successful conclusion of NAFTA, and let producers really look into those relationships. That, incidentally, I think would also resolve a lot of the issues on steel, because they are linked. So that is the one thing I think they could bring to a conclusion in the here and now. And that window is very short for what Mexico has to look at in terms of their upcoming election as well.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by our studios and filling us in on all of this.
Thanks, Ben.
That was Angela Hoffman, the Deputy Director of Farmers for Free Trade. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about a month ago. Mexico's $3 billion in tariffs on American goods went into effect in early June. The goods include pork, cheese, apples, potatoes, and whiskey. And this coming Friday, the Trump administration says it will impose tariffs on $34 billion in Chinese imports. China announced it would strike back with tariffs on an equal amount of U.S. exports. Chinese companies are also expected to cancel most of the remaining soybeans they've committed to buy from the U.S. by August 31st. This is Ozarks at Large.
91.3 is supported by the Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart.
Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain, located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m. Admission is free. 273-1329 or walmartmuseum.com. The 8th Annual Winslow Half Marathon and 5K Run is Saturday, September 15th. This run through the Boston Mountains of Northwest Arkansas will end at the Winslow Community Expo Center with music, food, and local vendors. Registration and information at winslowrun.com. 91.3 is supported by the City of Eureka Springs, featuring a variety of activities for the outdoor enthusiast of all ages. Eureka Springs is surrounded by various river and lake waterways, including Lake Leatherwood, a 1,600-acre city park crisscrossed with hiking and biking trails, and a spring-fed lake. Eureka Springs escape information at eurekasprings.org.
This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. It's about 18 and a half minutes before 1 o'clock.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. New consumer options for dining and banking will be arriving on the west side of Springdale early next year. And 2 months away from its 7th anniversary, Springdale furniture retailer James & James continues its impressive year-over-year growth. We'll catch up with owner James Smith for a conversation. And cupcakes are not a new idea, but a cupcake business that's reimagined and paying competitive wages to employees with special needs, that was worth something to a group of Springdale High School students recently at a week-long boot camp for aspiring entrepreneurs. We'll have details on all those stories next on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's one-comm.com.
A new retail shopping center called Sunset West Plaza is in development in Springdale. It's at the intersection of U.S. Highway 412 and Westside Village Street, just west of the Harbor Meadows area. A group that includes Rogers developer Burke Larkin paid a little more than $1 million for their 1.78-acre lot last month. Colliers International will manage the property once it is built, which is expected to be finished next spring. Colliers Executive Vice President Alan Cole says there are two tenants already signed for the shopping center. Little Rock-based pizza chain U.S. Pizza Company will lease about 5,000 square feet, and Boonville-based First Western Bank occupy about 3,300 square feet. Both companies are entering the Springdale market for the first time. U.S. Pizza has 16 locations in Arkansas, including one on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. First Western has 5 branches in Benton County and is one of the largest banks in that county in terms of deposit market share. You can find more details on the new development in the next issue of the Business Journal. Goes to press today, actually, and will be on newsstands and online next week. James Smith backed into a career in the furniture business out of necessity. Nearly 7 years later, it remains a runaway success. 2 months away from its 7th anniversary, James & James continues its impressive year-over-year growth. Without sharing specific revenue numbers, Smith said sales through the first half of the year are up almost 32% over the first half of 2017. The Business Journal has reported previously on the story of Smith's success. Out-of-work individual needs money, has an idea to make money, puts it into action, and makes a living from it. Voila, a thriving company is born. In a recent interview, I asked him if he imagined the kind of success the company is enjoying today, and what's driving such strong year-over-year growth in year seven.
James, you're a couple months shy of celebrating your seventh anniversary here at James & James. From those humble beginnings in your own garage, put that milestone in perspective for me. You've built quite a company, no pun intended.
Yeah, you know, I never would have imagined 7 years ago when we built that first coffee table in the garage in Rogers that we would have 17 full-time employees and be doing as much business as we're doing for the Fortune 100 companies that we're building for and the homes across the country. So it really, it's, you know, you have to stop every now and then and think. It's really exciting.
Right. Yeah. So now 2018, we're about right at the midway point of the calendar. How's the year shaping up? Where are the sales numbers trending this year in year seven? And just kind of recap the first half of the year and forecast the second half.
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, we're really excited to be trending over 30% over the first half of 2017. And that gets harder to post those double-digit numbers as you grow each year. So year being in year seven and posting, you know, over 30% growth for the first 6 months over last first 6 months is really, really exciting. We've been doing a lot of things very intentionally to grow, and it's exciting to see those things pay off.
Right. And so what are those things? What's driving that new growth? Is it new products, new customers, new markets? What's behind that?
It's really several things. I think first, it's definitely commercial sales. We've been doing a lot more builds for different businesses. We had Tyson, they made a commitment to buy locally when they opened up their downtown offices and renovated their offices at the global headquarters there. And so that was a nice job for us. Also, by having that job, that led us to connections that led to another large job with Microsoft that we just delivered yesterday up in St. Louis. And we're doing some more stuff for Microsoft's Birmingham office. So those large commercial orders definitely help. But our baseline business is up too, which is really exciting. We started, we're really well known for our dining tables, and we launched at the end of last year home office desks, and those have done incredibly well for us. And so we're excited to see that growth. And then we also have really transitioned. We started off with a lot more simplistic kind of farmhouse designs, and now we're selling a lot more elegant hardwood tables that have a higher price point than what we started off with in the garage.
Right. And so with all of that growth, what is the result of that? What is the main consequence that you deal with because of the growth, just in terms of, you mentioned your employees and your processes, your manufacturing, your logistics? What has been the response or the result of that growth in key terms?
Mm-hmm. It's been really great because it's enabled us to create better opportunities for the team members that are with us. Mm-hmm. And so that's exciting. We always want to grow our team. It's also... it's just been exciting in terms of, you know, giving us more purchasing power when we're going out and buying our raw materials, and then having these larger names underneath our belt when people approach us for, you know, projects, they know that, you know, they can trust us to deliver excellence and deliver it on time, you know.
Right. Now, you are an online business, but you do have a showroom component here in Springdale. Give me your thoughts on the evolution of retail, the brick and mortar versus the online argument.
Yeah, for us, at least 75% of our business is sent out of state. And even our local customers that come into our store here locally in Springdale, they usually found out about us online too. Mm-hmm. So for us, that's everything. We're really excited because right now, if you look at what's happening online, you've got companies like Wayfair and Amazon's home division that are selling billions of dollars in home furnishings. But if you really look at the numbers hard, their average cart size is very low, a couple hundred dollars. Really what they're selling is clocks and stools and throw blankets and pillows. And we really haven't seen that dam burst to where the vast majority of people are willing to purchase those larger pieces online, which is what we do mainly. And so we know that is just right around the corner. It's starting off with people getting comfortable buying things online by ordering a stool or something that's not as scary. And we know that in a matter of a few years, especially as the younger generation ages into the furniture buying population, that we're very, very well positioned. You know, a lot of furniture stores are just geographical. We know how to take an order for a custom table, have it built and shipped to Philly within 2 weeks without any damage. And that's something that a lot of our competitors, you know, can't say.
Right. How do you find good people and then keep them?
That is so hard, right? I think everybody is struggling with that, especially with the economy doing so well and unemployment being so low. Attracting and finding good help is everything. And so we just work really hard to make sure that our team feels really appreciated, that they really enjoy their work. I think a lot of our guys and gals that work at the wood shop, they like the fact that they have a job where at the end of the day, they can see what they built and what they made. And you don't get that sense of immediate satisfaction out of a lot of jobs. And so, you know, it's really fun in the weekly meetings to read through all the 5-star reviews we got that week and who built which piece for which customer that's leaving their review. And so we just work to have a superior culture and a place that people feel valued and feel like they're, you know, contributing and doing great things because they are.
Finally today, about a dozen campers completed a week-long entrepreneurship boot camp recently in Fayetteville, sponsored by the nonprofit Startup Junkie. Throughout the week, campers visited several Fayetteville startups and learned a lean canvas model for creating a business plan. They also learned about leadership and teamwork skills, time management, and customer development techniques. They also practiced 60-second elevator pitches. The winning pitch was made by students who designed a business plan for a cupcake company where a majority of employees have special needs. Their sweet idea was worth a winning prize of $500. There are more details on that story at nwabusinessjournal.com. And that's all the time we have today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Lee Wood, who is, well, let's tell you, she's two things. She's producer of the KUAF Vinyl Hour, Sunday evenings at 5 on KUAF 3. She's also membership director at KUAF. She will be speaking in both of those capacities for us.
Yes, I feel like I have a split personality.
First, I'm going to take the poll. I always ask someone in the building this every year around this time of year. Pro fireworks, do you do fireworks?
I don't shoot them off.
Because you're wise. And yeah. You want all your digits.
I like my digits. I like intact hands. I am a wimp when it comes to the sound, the loudness. So yeah. I don't really like it. I'll watch them from afar and think, wow, that's pretty. But I don't need to, like, participate.
I like to watch them on TV. I think they're pretty, like, every New Year's Eve, I watch, New Year's afternoon for us, I watch
Australia?
Reykjavik, Iceland.
Oh, and of course.
Because they go nuts for these things.
Yeah, yeah.
But watching them, but my wife Laura loves them. Not setting them off, but watching them and hearing the sounds.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's good. It's good for kids. My kids
sure,
like it.
Sure. Yeah. I got no problem with it. Part two on the Vinyl Hour Sunday evening at 5.
Yes. A firework of a man. Sorry. I had to do it. Frank Zappa. We're doing part two of Frank Zappa. We just couldn't fit it all into one show, which makes sense. So Rob Pressman is back. We're talking more about this interesting, singular person that was Frank Zappa, and really listening to songs this hour where he's really, it's more than making fun, he's skewering, right? So he's skewering the hippie scene in San Francisco, and then he's skewering sort of 50s suburbia, you know, square America, and he's skewering men's thoughts about women and religion and everything. I mean, he gets everybody.
He does.
Yeah. So that's really, we're listening to songs that are representative of that this hour. And Rob Pressman, his love, you know, he got his first Zappa album when he was 12.
Mm-hmm.
So it's lifelong for him. And it's endlessly fun talking about Frank Zappa with Rob Pressman. He really loves him and he knows his stuff and he can pick perfect songs to sort of explain what it is he's trying to get across. So
that's Sunday evening at 5, part two of Frank Zappa on the Vinyl Hour on KUAF 3. Now, as membership director, you're about to make someone's holiday even better.
Yes. So, because it's the beginning of a new month, we're drawing a winner of the Have a Night Out on Us program here, just saying a thank you to an active member of KUAF. And this month's winner is Jennifer Pierce of Bentonville, Arkansas.
What will Jennifer be doing on us?
We're giving her a gift certificate to a restaurant, two tickets to a Naturals baseball game. It's a voucher, so you can go and see any game that you'd like, and then two movie passes. So, you know, if it's really, really hot, go to the movie. when it's like a nicer night, go to the baseball game. That's my advice.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. And when you say an active member, at the first of every month on Ozarks Lodge, we do a night out on us. Mm-hmm. Active member means?
That you've given a gift to the station in the last 12 months.
All right. Lee Wood, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kyle.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Chris of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, on July 13, 1918, Benton County native Field Eugene Kindley scored the first kill for the American 148th Squadron, downing a German Albatross D-3 over Ypres. Kindley had previously flown with the Royal Flying Service's 65th Squadron, but transferred to the American unit when it was formed. Soon taking command of the 148th, Kindley proved to be a deadly pilot, eventually scoring 12 confirmed kills. This would be the third highest number of planes downed by any of the pilots in the Army Air Corps. By the time World War I ended, Kindley had won the British Distinguished Flying Cross and the American Distinguished Service Cross. Kindley remained in the Air Corps after the war, and on February 1, 1920, during a simulated bombing run, he stalled his plane to avoid hitting troops who had wandered onto the field and died in the ensuing crash. He is buried in Gravette. To learn more, visit ww1arkansas.com.
A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Gravette. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. We will end today with music from two of my favorite people in the world, Susan Shore and Michael Cockrum. Shore and Cockrum will be performing Sunday afternoon at the Fayetteville Public Library. It is part of their Mountain Street Stage Summer Music Series. It will begin at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and it's free. They'll be playing from 2 until 4. This is from a previous engagement when Shore and Cockrum were at the Carver Center for Public Radio performing for us. Have a great rest of your July 5th.
If you hold me, I will take a chance. You're the only girl I ever met that makes me want to dance. You make little tender boxes, old souls in vivid rooms, paste together joy and grief in a parody of gloom. You're a strong cup of coffee, you're a lively morning burn. You know you drive me crazy in the best sense of the word. Hey, Susan, when the band plays, you're liquid, I'm as stiff as clay. If you hold me, I will take a chance. You're the only girl I ever met that makes me want to dance. Curled up in the night, pairing scars and shooting stars until the morning light. And we still have this dance floor and a portion of our youth. I'm just glad to grow old with you to tell you the truth. Hey, Susan, when the band plays, you're liquid, I'm as stiff as clay. You know I love you, so I'll take a chance. You're the only girl I've met that makes me want to dance. The only girl I ever met likes the way I dance.